Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program was brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market. A New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com.
And one thing I learned, like, you know, I've done so many books with chefs. It's the same thing with great fishermen. You don't have to be the one who turns out the product. You just have to understand what your subject is doing, why they do it, what turns them on, what they're great at, you know, and then you write about it. So, you know, I often say it was like I got to take clarinet lessons from Benny Goodman, you know, both in cooking and in fishing. I've had experiences you can't buy, you know, to cook with Danielle Boulud for 2 weeks, you know, it's not for sale.
Heritage Radio Network proudly presents Evolutionaries, Peter Kaminsky. Peter Kaminsky is a Renaissance man, writer, outdoorsman, journalist, cookbook author, television producer, the list goes on and on. He's worked with the likes of Francis Mallmann and Daniel Boulud on cookbooks. He was a managing editor at National Lampoon. He created both the Kennedy Center Mark Twain Prize and the Library of Congress Gershwin Prize for popular song.
I grew up in New Jersey, and I moved to New York when I was like 22. Let me see. I went to Princeton, and I was living on a hippie farm, and I was working for a pipe organ maker. We were working on a couple of churches in New York. That was a little bit of the back to the land, back to the earth, you know, crunchy times. And I felt I really didn't know how to do anything with my hands. I'd never learned. And the town where this farm was that I was living on had a guy who built pipe organs, and he had advertised for help. So I said, gee, I'll learn to do something with my hands. I never learned to do it very well. No, you just, you know, life leads you from one thing into another. I went to grad school in anthropology at NYU and really enjoyed it. I was poverty stricken and tried to get a job in advertising. So I wrote some ads and it ended up, the stuff I wrote, on the desk of the publisher of National Lampoon. So they hired me to write the publisher's sort of, you know, flack letter every month. And, you know, pretty soon it became clear that my talents lay more on the editorial side of that magazine. So I became an editor and writer of Lampoon. And I was there for almost 4 years. And that's where I learned to write. A lot of it by writing badly. But I became a writer. You had to be armed for bear every day, because the job at National Lampoon was not to write the magazine. It was to find a weakness in the character armor of your colleagues and to all pounce on it like piranha and rip them to shreds. So you had to come pretty secure every day. And, you know, nobody ever does. So you all get, you know, eviscerated at some point. Well, yeah, it was really important. It made me a New Yorker, made me a writer. While I was at Lampoon, which was a very crazy, druggy, drinky place, I got serendipitously interested in fishing and fly fishing, and which I still do and love, you know, beyond words. But it was a really good antidote to life at the Lampoon. And then when I left, I guess it's not ungenerous to say the bar was kind of low in outdoor writing. So I was able to feed myself writing for Field and Stream and Sports Afield, and I got to go to places, you know, that New Yorkers don't go to that much. I got to travel a lot in the South and the Midwest and little towns, and you know, that to me was as exotic as Europe, you know, where I'd been already. So I wrote about that.
But it wasn't fishing Peter would become ultimately known for. He would soon find his love for food writing, and it would change his career.
I guess the great transition came in 93 or 94, I did a series called The Season on the Harbor. And every month, I would fish in a different spot in New York City waters and write about the fishing and the lore and the ecology. And it was just, it's such a rich subject. And for the last story of the year, I was going to have lunch with my roommate from Princeton, Vinnie Farrell, and I had gone out on a party boat from Sheepshead Bay with my older daughter, Lucy. So she would have been 9 at the time. We were fishing for blackfish, also known as tautog. And, you know, most of the guys on the boat brought rods, left them up, you know, tied to the railing, went down and played penny a point or nickel a point pinochle. But Lucy and I and a guy named Eddie Doles, who just happened to be at our side, who's the was the walrus keeper at the Coney Island Aquarium, he showed us how to catch blackfish. And we caught a dozen of them. And Michael LaMonaco, he was the chef at 21, quite famous as being the chef at Windows on the World, who went to get his eyeglasses that morning instead of taking the elevator up to the tragedy. I knew Mike through other friends through fishing. I wasn't a food writer. And he had wanted some advice about tackle and stuff to take his kid fishing. And so I called Mike up and I said, I got a dozen blackfish. And, can you make us lunch? And you can, you know, sell the rest of them. So I showed up at 21 Club with my little red igloo. And I remember being online at the coat check. And in front of me was Frank Gifford and Ethel Kennedy. And Frank Gifford asked, did you bring your lunch? I said, as a matter of fact, I did. And we got into a conversation about fishing, because he liked to fish too, apparently. So I wrote that up, and we had blackfish, we had something with truffles, I mean, scallops with truffles. It was a great lunch. And the Times gave it, like, more than half a page with a big picture of Eddie, who was a real Damon Runyon New York character, and Michael flipping pans, you know, in 21 Club. And I got an enormous amount of response for that, more than anything I'd ever done, except for the column I wrote after 9/11. And I said, well, this food thing. So I decided to be a food writer. And I got a assignment from the New Yorker to write about the opening of Gramercy Tavern, which was a story that they bought, that they commissioned and paid for, but Tina Brown, as with many stories, said, nah, just doesn't sing. However, Kurt Anderson, who was the editor of New York Magazine, when I had told him originally about the story, I would kill for that story. So I called him up and said, Kurt, remember you said you'd kill for the story? And he said, yes, you don't have to. So he bought it and he put it on the cover, and it made an enormous, there had never been a story like that, you know. It was like 9,000 words about the opening of a restaurant. So I was in the food world, and the woman who had been writing Underground Gourmet was leaving, and Kurt offered that to me. So I took it. So I really was in the food world, and I started to meet chefs and stuff. I went with Tom Colicchio to a fly fishing weekend, and a picnic, and there was some fly fishing at it of chefs upstate New York and on the Esopus Creek. And I gave some casting lessons, I remember, and I met Gray Coons, who was the great chef of Les Menaces, and we became friends. So eventually that became my first food book, The Elements of Taste, with Gray.
Use your brain.
Peter Kaminsky didn't just stop at food. Always ready to strike when opportunity arises, he ended up creating the Kennedy Center Mark Twain Prize for American Humor.
Use your brain.
I had this idea. I'd been asked to write and produce some non-televised tributes for the Museum of the Moving Image. One was for Robin Williams, and one was for Steven Spielberg. And at the same time, my brother and I were producing the 20th anniversary of People magazine on ABC. Big budget. And you couldn't get anybody to be on that show. You know, to get a letter to Oprah Winfrey, you had to know someone who knew the hairdresser's cousin, you know. And unless you were in rehab or your kid had died, you didn't want to have anything to do with People magazine. You know, I mean, it's just, that's the facts. And at the same time, I'm doing this Spielberg tribute. And, you know, hello, Peter, Oprah. Hello, Peter, Liam Neeson. So the thought occurred to me, as with anyone, oh, if you're doing a show in tribute to somebody, and it's somebody everybody likes, or somebody who's important, or somebody who writes checks, you're going to get people to show up. And I realized there was no award, big award, for American humor. So I said, let's make one. Let's call it the Mark Twain Prize. And we had just honored George Burns at the Montreal Comedy Festival. And George was almost 100 at that point. So that winter we'd picked up a job. Colin Powell had this big thing of all the living presidents. It's called America's Promise, you know, to get volunteers to work with at-risk kids. And Clinton was there, and, you know, Nancy Reagan was there, George Bush was there, Ford was there. And so it came off pretty well. So we knew the people in the Clinton White House. So we went to say, why don't we make a thing called the Mark Twain Prize? It couldn't sound more American. And we'll do it for George Burns at the White House. And Ann Stock was the social secretary for Hillary Clinton at the time. And she thought it was a great idea. But then there was the Whitewater eruption. And, you know, you have to be careful with comics. And the White House just didn't want to take any chances. But Ann left and went to the Kennedy Center, and we pitched it there. It took about 2 seconds for them to say yes. And fortuitously, we got a call from Motown saying people should do something for Richard Pryor, who was so sick. So we said, yeah. So Richard Pryor became the first Mark Twain Prize honoree, and the world showed up for him. Robin showed up, Whoopi showed up, Danny Glover, Morgan Freeman, Kris Kristofferson. I mean, I can't remember. It was just did I say Damon Wayans? I mean, it was a great group. And so that was established, and now, you know, 17 years later, we've done it, you know. Tina Fey, Bob Newhart, Jonathan Winters, Whoopi, Will Ferrell, Jay Leno. So it's kind of an annual. So since it was our idea, my brother and I are the producers, and we have two other partners as well, Mark Krantz and Kathy McGar. So that's how that happened.
His most recent book, Culinary Intelligence, found Peter exploring his diet and sharing what he learned along the way.
I was borderline diabetic, and I weighed 204 pounds. Food writing and wine writing are not as healthy as, like, being a Zen writer about Zen practices. I was pretty overweight, eating the wrong things. So I had to change my diet. And I read a lot, I studied a lot, and I wrote a book about it called Culinary Intelligence. For me, it wasn't that hard to lose weight. I cut out, as they all say, the white stuff, smaller portions, never eat dessert unless you have to, you know, for your writing or because you're going to insult the hostess. Never finish it anyway. One glass of wine with dinner, tops two. Never cocktails and wine. Eat whole foods, whole ingredients. I mean, it's sort of the pillars that came out of it was don't eat processed food. Buy the very best whole ingredients you can afford. And if that's turnips, you can make them be delicious, you know. And cook or live with somebody who does. Because home cooking can be very healthful. Restaurant cooking, I mean, one of the reasons we like it so much is restaurant chefs know the shortcuts to hitting your hot buttons of, you know, fat and salt and sweet. But you can make stuff just as delicious at home without, you know, pulling out that bag of tricks. And so I lost a lot of weight. And it was during that time I wrote a dessert cookbook with Michelle Richard, and I wrote Seven Fires with Frances Mallmann. So it was a lot of meat, you know, red wine and stuff, but just control the intake. That's the biggest thing, controlling your intake. Eating is an environmental act. You know, what you consume and how it fits into, you know, the chain of life, you know, determines so much of what happens on the planet. You know, I think Dan Barber in The Third Plate, you know, got away from what's on the, you know, on the plate into questions of the soil. And that's tremendously important. Now, I just read a new study, you know, once again, you know, saying that animals are, you know, consume too much of the environment, so raising meat is, you know, environmentally suspect. But I don't agree. It's a very compact form of protein in nutrition. In 1880, there was as much meat on the hoof in the continental United States as there is today, right? Same exact biomass. Except it cost nothing to feed them because they were buffalo, all right? And those buffalo were part of an ecosystem, you know, a complex ecosystem, you know, where the activity of, you know, their paws and their weight, you know, helped seeds embed themselves in the soil or germinate. I'm tremendously interested in the way animals or a succession of animals are create an environment that creates a lot of nutrition. Monoculture is going to destroy any environment. You know, it's got terrible consequences. But, you know, you look at a place like the west of Spain, where there's a cycle of pigs, goats, sheep, cows and goats that go through the grasslands, you know, or move through it. It's not unlike the way you get impala and wildebeest moving through the Serengeti. You know, they all eat a different part of the grass, and together that and the, you know, their droppings create a self-sustaining environment. So I think ingenious or people just have their eyes open, that we can learn to let animals manage our land better, and there will be nutritious food to be had without quite the environmental tolls. The Great Plains weren't made to support wheat. They need an awful lot of fertilizer. They need an awful lot of, you know, insecticide, but they do support a great number of grasses that can support animals. That's where the idea for the Buffalo Commons came from. You know, so much of the land is, you know, unarable anymore. Return animals to it, and it will return. That's a long way of saying, you know, I think there are larger environmental, questions that still have to be taken up by the, you know, what we call the food movement. It's something I'm interested in writing more about. You know, this whole idea of rewilding, I think, is really provocative and interesting. It strikes my fancy. I think it's very romantic. I think it's beautiful. If you ever see some land that's been brought back by letting the animals manage it, it's uplifting. I mean, why do you like music? I mean, it's just nice. There's never very specific advice you can give to people to how to, like, advance their cause. I mean, recognize opportunity and always take the next good thing. I never had a life plan, you know, just took the next good thing, you know, and a little bit of good fortune. I mean, I'm just a guy who gets by. I'm not, like, you know, a super famous, super rich guy, but I've, you know, been everywhere and met everyone, and you know, got to write what I wanted to write about. These days, it's hard to tell people how to get started as a writer. I mean, I think you have to be willing to write for free. You know, if you can get a well-read blog, that's going to get you somewhere, or it can get you somewhere. You know, there's more outlets now for video, you know, to become that kind of a personality. People have to want to be with you. You know, it used to be they wanted to buy, you know, Gourmet magazine, and then you'd be in it. Now they want to, you know, they want to buy you. So you have to find a way to reach other people. And, you know, good writing is always important in the end, and that means you need to write a lot. I remember there was a piece in the Times Book Review some years ago where Norman Mailer wrote, and he said, you know, I read the stuff that, you know, I wrote in my senior year at Harvard, and it was pretty good. He said, and I realized by that time in my life, I'd written about 1 million words. You know, so he'd written the bad stuff out of his system. So, I mean, writing is very enjoyable. You know, eating and having a roof over your head are also very enjoyable. But if you can take care of that, you know, writing is just wonderful to get lost in. You know, whenever I've had rough times in my life, when I am writing, I'm okay.
Peter lives in Cobble Hill, Brooklyn, and continues to constantly explore food and the world that surrounds it. This piece was produced by Aaron Fairbanks and Jack Inslee for HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The songs used in this piece, in order of appearance, are Lazy LA by Odetta Hartman, End of the World by Odetta Hartman, Brains by Uptown Nico, Meeting at the Docks by RecTech, Curry Row by RecTech, and again, Lazy LA by Odetta Hartman.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.